The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
With the Wells Fargo Active Cash Credit Card, you can earn unlimited 2% cash rewards on purchases you want and purchases you need. That means you earn 2% cash rewards on what you want, like season tickets to watch your favorite team, and 2% cash rewards on what you need, like paying for parking. That's the beauty of the Active Cash Credit Card. It's ready when you are, with unlimited 2% cash rewards. The Wells Fargo Active Cash Credit Card. That's real life ready. Terms apply. Learn more at wellsfargo.com/activecash.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to week 13 of A Good Football Show. No, it's week 3 season, though. We're already in the swing of it. I am Patrick Daugherty, joined today by Danny Carter. We will be assessing the zero RB lay of the land. You know, everyone's favorite strategy that works.
Everyone's.
We will also check in on some of the league's more like moribund receiver cores. See maybe if there's some of these receiver cores that actually have any value in them whatsoever, and we will discuss defenses that have displayed early vulnerabilities up the seam against tight ends. But Denny, yeah, we're through 2 weeks. Are you still alive in the playoff hunt in any of your leagues, or have Giovanni Bernard and Rashad Penny already kind of knocked you out?
I never heard of either of those guys. I'm fine. Everything's fine. CPAT is my RB1, like I said last week, in all leagues. So that that was fun last week. And I mean, look, CPAT RB1 over Saquon RB1. I don't mean to trigger you, but it's happening.
Yeah, I mean, it is. I mean, we're going to get into CPAT a little later in the show. He got every important touch for the Falcons in week 2, I will say. And we didn't really have anything planned for the beginning of the show, but I was just wondering, I don't know if this is like real estate, like your area of expertise. What kind of house do you think Urban Meyer is looking for in Los Angeles? Is he going to be on the beach? Is he going to be more inland so he can focus right. Modern or, you know, like Chinatown era LA, you know, like Jack Nicholson, Hollywood, early 30s glamour? What kind of house is he going to be going for?
Man, all those sound like excellent options. I have to say, after seeing pictures of his house in Jacksonville, I have to say he's only looking for a house with enough room for tables that he can fill full of pictures. and if the listeners don't know what I'm talking about, look up some, you know, Urban Meyer house or something on Google, and you will find just the strangest decor you've ever seen.
Yeah, there was an article on defector.com called Urban Meyer's House is Freaking Me Out, Man. And it caught the spirit of the thing. I think if Herb ended up coaching USC in Los Angeles, his only qualification would be like, my house needs to be 5 times larger than Cliff Kingsbury's. I think it'd just be like a palace of glass.
Yeah.
Even though he only, but it'd be like this giant glass palace, like the biggest glass house in the world, basically. But he does all of his work in like a fully walled off interior bathroom. So he can just be, the glass is all just for show.
I think, you know, him and Cliff Kingsbury are going for the villain in Miami Vice type house. You know, that's and the Zoomers will get this, obviously. The kids listening to the show will definitely understand that reference. But that's sort of how I see it. You know, things are going well when you have to issue a statement after week 2 in your second game as the head coach of a franchise, saying, please, everybody, don't give up on us. After 2 weeks.
I think they did it kind of in week 1 too. And then an even better sign is that the Falcons did the same thing. Yeah. And then the Jaguars Twitter account was like, hold on, you're stealing our bit about apologizing for the team sucking? We'll see you in court. How about that, Arthur Smith? How about that, Arthur Blank?
That's right. Yeah.
You think we don't got lawyers?
Right. We apologize to our fans for perpetually being terrible on every facet of the game. Don't you dare try that, Falcons. Although the Falcons do obviously owe everybody. In a
they do. The Jaguars thing, too, is the ultimate, like, I think I saw someone tweet, like, who was asking for this? Like,
I don't know.
It's like the ultimate thou doth protest too much.
Yeah, and Urban Meyer even cited the area code of Jacksonville in his comment. Like, nobody in the 904 has to worry about us working hard. That, you know, stop. Just stop trying to pretend that you're part of the community. He's not. And he won't be for very long.
I mean, there are like two famous area codes in the entire country, and one of them is not the Jacksonville area code. So
I'm sorry to be an elitist, folks, but
yeah, don't try to make that into a thing, Urban. It's time to move on to Zero RB, as it always, always is on the show. It's everyone's favorite, least favorite strategy. That is really just more of a survival mechanism than a clever drafting technique. Denny, we finally have some data points for all of our zero RB backfields. And even though it's only been 2 weeks, we are kind of already nearing decision time with a lot of these people. Injuries are piling up. There's only a few weeks left until buys. Buys actually start a lot later than usual this year. Buys used to start in week 4 most seasons. They do not start until week 6 this year. So you have like a little more time to hold people on your bench than you otherwise would. But yeah, I mean, the injuries are piling up. You need roster churn already. We'll start with the Jets backfield. Michael Carter was one of our summer favorites, not just in zero RB, just kind of for all drafters, a really high upside, real hyped young rookie runner. He's mired in a 3-man committee. Is there hope with Michael Carter, Denny? Who should we be rostering in this Jets backfield? Who should we be dropping?
I mean, week 2 was a little bit shocking because Michael Carter was utilized. He rushed 11 times for 59 yards in the loss to the Patriots. He added 2 catches for 29 yards, saw 3 targets in the game. You know, he looked to be the best runner in the Jets backfield, despite Ty Johnson, you know, functioning as the starter. Ty Johnson led the backfield with 12 carries and had 50 yards. Tevin Coleman, your favorite player of all time, had 5 rushes for 24 yards. You know, there's like I think we said many times in the summer, there's just so little upside with Tevin Coleman. I think Michael Carter is rosterable right now. It really depends on the composition of your team. You know, if you're pretty solid, even pretty solid at running back, no reason to hold on to Michael Carter. If you are needy, if you are thirsty in the running back department, like your co-host, then I think holding on to Michael Carter would be a good thing. Ty Johnson's not going anywhere, though. So I think everything is kind of capped here in the Jets backfield.
I mean, the game script was really weird in week 2 for the Jets, blown out by the Patriots. But it was 13 touches for Michael Carter. And I think this will eventually just become a 2-man ordeal instead of a 3-man. Like, I kid a lot about Tevin Coleman, but I do genuinely believe like he's droppable. And I think this will eventually, or he'll just get hurt. And this will turn into a Michael Carter, Ty Johnson thing. Ty Johnson, well, we're hoping to bank some receptions. Is that the plan with Ty Johnson, Denny?
That is the plan. The thesis is that Ty Johnson is going to get a bunch of targets in a Jets offense that's, you know, constantly throwing the ball in negative game script. I guess, you know, how often does that work out? You know, not
very
not
rarely. At all. But like, I think the Jets are kind of moving on to evaluation mode already. And, you know, everyone knows what we have in Tevin Coleman. I think the Michael Carter role will grow. I mean, the summer hype wasn't for no reason. They do really like Michael Carter. Yeah. And especially with buys starting a little later than I realized, I would definitely hold on to Michael Carter for several more weeks. I would gamble and drop Tevin Coleman. Yeah, Ty Johnson, I think, is just like one of those necessary evils on your bench. Like, you don't love it, but you got to keep him around because he's getting enough touches and receptions are more valuable than rushes. So
keep
Ty. And a real quick thought, by the way, with Tevin Coleman, I always compare Tevin Coleman and Sammy Watkins. And in the great game between, say, like Littlefinger's Tevin Coleman and Varys's Sammy Watkins, I don't know, Game of Thrones watchers, Zoomers have never heard of it. I would say Varys and Sammy Watkins are winning. They're actually having a little bit of value. Tevin Coleman and Littlefinger are looking in real trouble in the great power struggle between the Titans of football.
I have to say, I've seen every episode of Game of Thrones, and I had trouble following that one. So
one of the theories of Game of Thrones, like the two, I mean, the show obviously screwed it all up towards the end, but like the two true power players in Westeros were Varys and Littlefinger. was always kind of one of like the theories about the books and the show. Like they were like the truly two most powerful people, the ones lining up the chess pieces.
Yeah.
And yeah, I don't know how that really compares to Sammy Watkins.
I don't either.
And Tevin Coleman. It's like a great power game, a great power struggle between them. That's kind of what I was going.
A power struggle to disappoint fantasy
players. Yes, yes, exactly. To be the most disappointing wide receiver for RB3 in Westeros, basically. Exactly. Yeah, the Zoomer, you should look up Game of Thrones. I mean, if you don't watch the final season, don't ever count on the two final books coming out. But Zoomers, you should Google Game of Thrones.
Well, my suggestion would be only to watch the first season. It would have been a fantastic one season show.
So the first season is one of the greatest seasons of any television show in history.
Right.
And I would say season four is also one of the greatest shows of any television show in history. And that after season five is okay, then like the final three seasons are a disaster. Two and three are fine. Even the disastrous seasons are kind of gripping. It's not
I mean, the show went off course when they stopped hating the fans.
Yeah, it's true.
In order to have a good show, you have to really truly despise the fans and just rub their nose in the worst things possible throughout the show. Once you start pleasing the fans, the show is off the rails and terrible.
Well, this coincided, of course, with George R.R. Martin running out of pages. And the second they got past George R. R. Martin, it was basically you and me writing the show. Like, you know, this guy dies for some reason. I don't know why.
There's another dragon. Sure.
Yeah. Yeah. The dragon's got blue fire for some reason now. anyways, the Bucks, zero RB. We thought Giovanni Bernard would be a life hack, Dennis. We thought Ronald Jones would at least offer big play ability. Once again, though, the only reliable back so far has been playoff Leonard Fournette. Give us the state of the Bucks backfield. Is there any reason to hold the non-Fournette running backs?
I take absolutely zero pleasure in saying that the Giovanni Bernard thesis was completely wrong.
It was wrong.
18% snap share through two games, only six snaps in week two. Now, he did suffer some sort of high ankle injury like right before the season started. He wasn't on the injury list. I get that. I get that. So I'm not trying to create an excuse here, but a guy doesn't suffer a high ankle sprain and is instantly fine. So I'm wondering if that's lingering at all, that he's practicing in full, but he's just not quite right. But here's the thing. Leonard Fournette is, you know, he's in on 2-minute drills. He's getting a lot of the passing down work. The Bucks backfield is just not going to deliver a whole lot of production, and especially not Bernard. You can drop him safely.
Yeah, so high ankle sprains can linger for 9 years, by the way, if you don't do the physical therapy as prescribed when it first happens, like I may have done when I was 21 years old. So please get that taken care of, folks, if you have that. And I mean, I think Rojo's an auto drop. Giovanni Bernard, I think what's happening with Giovanni Bernard is that I think he's like the true 2-minute drill back, but like the literal 2-minute drill back. Like Giovanni Bernard is like on the field at the end of halves, kind of.
Yeah.
And that is it. Like the third down back has basically been Leonard Fournette. They have actually brought Gio on like at the end of game and like end of half situations, kind of. But that's been like literally it. And I don't know if that's some plan to like really ration his snaps and then like he'll eventually actually turn into like the third down back. But Leonard Fournette seems to be the third down back. He's getting an absurd amount of targets despite being a horrible pass catcher and like turn one into a turnover in week one. But, you know, Rojo, I mean, he made another mental mistake in week two. He ran out of bounds ahead of getting a first down. It was very baffling if you were watching the game. Bruce Arians just seems totally Joker-fied on Ronald Jones. And we know that, Leonard Fournette makes people the Joker too, but it's hard to see. I think he's put enough distance between himself and Rojo at this point where don't just drop Rojo just because this is a crazy situation. Things change like week to week. But if you're already facing like tough roster decisions, I do think Ronald Jones is dropping.
Look, Fournette is tied for fourth in running back targets through two weeks.
I actually didn't know it was that bad.
Man, that stinks. That is not what we were promised.
I didn't know it was that bad. And Gio Bernard, I mean, again, we know things change week to week in this Bucks backfield. And there's still room for this Gio role to grow. But too. I tweeted on Sunday. He literally looked like Matt Asiata going side to side. If the Zoomers actually should look up Matt Asiata for a nice little laugh, but he had like no lateral agility whatsoever. And
you're
until
talking about
like,
Bernard?
What?
You're talking about Bernard?
Gio Bernard. And until he like actually starts coming in from like run of the mill third downs, it's just impossible to see fantasy value developing there. You mentioned your RB1, Denny. That is Cordarrell Patterson.
Okay.
Nature abhors a change of pace vacuum. Cordarrell has filled it. Is this serious? Are we buying in? And are we trying to like, I don't know, would we be selling high or selling low on Mike Davis? Are we buying into Cordarrell? What are we doing with Mike Davis?
Oh, I mean, I can't imagine anybody like, you know, interested in trading for Mike Davis.
I will say, okay, people, there's always crazy people out there interested in everything. And like, it could be a deep league or like, well, this guy's just giving up on Mike Davis for no reason. I'll take these touches. Like everyone always thinks they're more clever than everyone else. So I do think there are people that would trade for Mike Davis.
Yeah. I was going to talk about the usage here in the Atlanta backfield through two games. So Davis actually has 34 touches, which is a lot more than Patterson's 21 touches, obviously. Also, Mike Davis has played a very nice 69% of the offensive snaps for the Falcons, while Patterson has played just 33% through two games. Patterson is getting more high value touches, and it seems like the Falcons are kind of acknowledging that like, oh, you're going to have to be like a thing in this offense because we don't have much going on. Because Ridley, you know, Calvin Ridley is no longer a focal point, and Kyle Pitts is still kind of getting acclimated per Arthur Smith. So, although he did have a really good game, we might be able to talk about that later. Anyway, I mean, I think Patterson is startable. So he has running back eligibility on a lot of fantasy sites. That's fantastic for those who, like me, need, you know, some people to plug into the running back spot. I think you can do that fairly confidently. You know, the Falcons get the Giants this week. That's a pretty good matchup. And most weeks, they're just going to have to do what they did last week and week one, just drop back and throw. That's good for Patterson. He's obviously a wide receiver by trade and excels in, you know, in those situations. So I think CPAT is a real thing in 12-team leagues.
I mean, you mentioned high-value touches, and I still don't know if it was kind of anecdotal, but I watched that game. I covered that game, and basically every big play they had in Cordarrell Patterson instead of Mike Davis. Like if they had a big third and short, if they had a big fourth and short, many times near the goal line, we had a 10-yard touchdown run, 7-yard touchdown catch where he threw a really critical block, then leaked out when Matt Ryan was under pressure. He got a wildcat snap in the red zone. So they certainly seem to view him. They definitely view him as like their change of pace back, like their big playback. And yet, I mean, they've diagnosed that behind Calvin Ridley and Kyle Pitts, I mean, there is no one capable of making plays. Russell Gage is already like really banged up. He's like checking in and out of the game constantly. Like I said, Kyle Pitts doesn't have a sea legs underneath him. And Calvin Ridley, if you're listening, gonna need more. Gonna need a little more.
Please.
And please, God, anything more, Cal. Anything you got. But yeah, I mean, CPAT, week one, you could have maybe chalked it up as a fluke. Week two, the role grew. He was pretty good with it. We've seen him with this role before. He's probably hard capped still. Around. He had 12 touches in week two. That might be like his ceiling for touches. Mm-hmm. But 8 to 10 weekly touches is feeling very, very reasonable with Cordarrell Patterson.
Yeah, and remember how much more valuable a reception is than a carry. And, you know, so in PPR formats, the only legitimate scoring system, you know, he has 12 touches are plenty. That's plenty for Patterson to deliver some sort of, you know, fantasy output for your zero RB team or modified zero RB team or however you approach it. Now, if if you're set at running back, you don't have to worry about any of this, which is good for you. Good on you.
Some could argue, Denny, that with Cordarrell, you actually did anchor RB or hero RB. Like you drafted him actually very early to be like a linchpin, right?
I did.
Like it was in the second round, actually.
You know, look, the mainstream media pushed back on me, but I continued to hammer CPAT in the second round. I didn't care what anybody said.
You didn't. It's working out so far.
Yeah.
What is not working out so far is the Chargers running backs behind Austin Eckler. And thankfully, by the way, Austin Eckler went from 0 catches in week 1 to 9 catches in week 2. That always seemed like we already knew about the pass catching connection between him and Justin Herbert. You know, with Joe Lombardi, you know, Alvin Kamara's OC coming to LA, there was never any real worry about that. But behind, so speaking of vacuums, behind Austin Eckler is just a total vacuum. So the rookie from Missouri, Larry Roundtree, seemed to have like ever so tenuous grip on it, but he had lost it after one negative carry in week two. They kind of went back to Justin Jackson, but that was like what, four carries. And so like, say you went true zero RB, Denny, it's like a 12 to 14 team league. I guess who are we prioritizing behind Austin Eckler? I mean, anybody, or is there even a good answer to give listeners on this?
You know, not really. It's not Joshua Kelly. So it's either Roundtree or Justin Jackson. And all summer, the assumption, according to every beat writer and every observer of the Chargers, was that Justin Jackson has that RB2 role locked down. And Justin Jackson has been pretty good when given some sort of opportunity, right? I think it would be him. But Roundtree got good run in week one against Washington, was explosive, had two pretty long runs against a really good football team defense. I know it always sounds
funny. No, I just can't ever stop laughing.
Yeah, I hate the name so much. So then you thought, oh, okay, well it's Roundtree. But right now I would say probably Justin Jackson, given that he's a veteran, given that for 2 months leading into the season, it seemed to be him. I would lean rostering him over Roundtree.
It is weird. They always seem like they're looking for reasons to go away from Justin Jackson. I mean, maybe they're triggered by his tweets.
It's not political.
Not to get political on the show. They might be triggered by his tweets, but
it's censorship.
They do seem to always be wanting to go away from him. Like they have no, like, and it seems like they just have like he's just a guy. Like they know he's their best option behind Austin Eckler, but every week they're like, well, what if he's not? And then he always is, because he is. I have Larry Roundtree stashed at the end of like 14 team league benches. I'm in a couple of 14 teamers. I'm still keeping him stashed probably this week, but if I had to choose him, I'm definitely choosing Justin Jackson, because every time carry reception, I mean, he hits like the benchmarks. He's always 4 to 5 yards per carry. He's always like 8 yards per catch. Like he seems to be a very good change of pace complimentary back. Mm-hmm. And I feel like at some point they're going to have to commit to him. Because yeah, it's not Josh Kelly. Like that experiment's over, and Larry Roundtree's just a guy.
I mean, very small sample, the smallest possible sample, really. But well, not quite, because it's not one, you know. But Justin Jackson is averaging 5.3 yards per carry this season. Larry Roundtree is averaging 2.8. So yeah, you know,
we both know those aren't huge sample sizes.
No, and they're it's very small. But Justin Jackson is probably the superior player, so I'd go him.
They are playing the Ravens this week, and the Raiders didn't run well against the Ravens. The Chiefs didn't run well, so wouldn't really expect much separation this week. We've gone through some backfields. I'm just going to throw some individual names at you real quick, Denny. Kenny Gainwell, have we seen enough to kind of consider him part of an actual zero RB strategy, someone who can actually come in and can get you real points in your flex? Or is the offense too volatile? What are your feelings on Kenneth Gainwell after 2 weeks?
Yeah, well, look, he has 15 carries to Miles Sanders, 28 carries through two games. He has the only rushing touchdown for Philadelphia running backs. I think that, you know, I mean, in 14 team leagues with like multiple flex spots, so I'm talking like deep formats, he definitely should be rostered and should be probably in your starting lineup every week, considering his usage. The fact that he's going to be on the field no matter the game script. His upside, I suppose, is being the primary three, like close to three down back, probably along maybe with some Boston Scott thrown in there if Miles Sanders misses any time this season. But yeah, I mean, he should be a target if he's out there. I'm not sure what his rostership is in 12 team leagues. I can check that in a second, but if he's out there, you need to get him. If you're thirsty,
I don't remember if it's north of 50% or not when I did my early waivers look on Monday. I mean, it's high, but it's not like he's not anywhere close to universal rostership. And yeah, I mean, this is going to be a really volatile offense. So there's going to be weeks where Kenny Gainwell probably gets like 2 to 3 touches, but he's had at least 8 touches through each of the first 2 weeks. So
yeah,
basically it's easy to feel disappointed, but like basically if you drafted Kenneth Gainwell as a zero RB, you have got what you were looking so far.
Right. He's available in 65%, which
okay, yeah. I mean, he should be much higher than that. I mean, we know that there are people out there who aren't sick and just play in like normal type leagues where you don't have to like go all in on people like Kenneth Gainwell.
Yeah.
But he should be over 50% because 8 touches back to back weeks, living up to summer expectations for his role. That's someone who should be rostered. James Conner, Denny. James Conner should be rostered, I think, obvious. But like,
yeah.
What is this? Is he living up to expectations? Is he coming in under expectations? What's like the indicator light basically on James Conner?
I don't think, you know, he's probably not playable in any format but the deepest. It is telling though that he has only 4 more rushing attempts than Chase Edmonds through 2 games. You know, he hasn't done much with that. He's only averaging 3.2 yards per carry, and Edmonds is much more productive on fewer carries. Not sure why the Cardinals don't go more all in on Chase
Edmonds. It is interesting.
That's a question that I have personally.
I've had for several years.
They just don't want to do it. You know, I feel like Kingsbury at this point is like, you can't make me.
Yeah, they've got some of the Daryl Henderson syndrome there with Sean McVay, even though Sean McVay went away from that for 2 weeks. Like, they seem to have just determined that Chase Edmonds cannot hold up under bigger workloads, but
right.
Maybe you should at least try to find out.
Let's give it a try. It's a bold strategy to have a dynamic, explosive rusher get the ball more, you know, but let's see if it works. Anyway, James Conner, clear stash in 12-team leagues for those who are looking for that sort of thing or into that sort of thing. You know, he could just fall into a bunch of volume if anything happens to Edmonds. I'm not sure so much about pass catching stuff, but with the way that Arizona offense is clicking and just burning teams up through the air, you got to think that some easy rushing touchdowns are coming. Although Kyler Murray obviously is an issue for whoever is in the backfield, you know, near the goal line for the Cardinals.
God, I love Kyler Murray.
With
Connor, basically, I think the take is that he has not risen above stash status. Like, he's obviously, you don't need us to explain why James Conner is a good bench option. Someone have stashed on your bench, but he hasn't risen above that. Like, the standalone value just hasn't been compelling enough. He's gotten a few goal line carries, but Chase Edmonds is basically being used as expected. He's getting explosive play opportunities, both in the running game and the passing game. And James Conner has not really pushed him. And I think it's just stash status with James Conner.
Mm-hmm.
Malcolm Brown, I don't know if you know, I was going to ask you about this one, but I mean, this is something I wanted to be a thing. Not because of the preseason game. All summer, I clung to one Miami Herald article, which is a very, very plugged in, the paper's like most plugged into a team. So like, I do give it heavy weight, but they were like, the coaching staff loves Malcolm Brown near the goal line. They love him on early downs. Then it translated to the preseason. I'm like, this guy, I'm going to have him every one of my benches. But I mean, should I be dropping Malcolm Brown?
I just don't know why you would need to roster Malcolm Brown, not just you, our listeners as well. This Miami backfield, especially if Tua misses time with this rib injury, which seems probable at this point, we'll see. I mean, it's a mess. It's a disaster. Really, like, you're not starting in the 12-team league with like standard size benches and everything. You're not starting a Dolphins running back, and
you may be starting Miles Gaskin, catching just enough passes. I'll let you finish your spiel though first.
I don't know. I mean, he only has 21% of the backfield of the total opportunities, which leads the Dolphins backfield. Salvin Ahmed has 13% and Malcolm Brown has 10%. But, you know, I just don't see a scenario where you can, with any sort of confidence, roll out Miles Gaskin. Now, I guess maybe that goes without saying. But, no, to answer your question, I think you can drop Malcolm Brown.
Yeah, the Dolphins are in the unfortunate position of – they realized what a lot of people realized over the summer. Like, I have zero Myles Gaskin exposure in redraft leagues. Like, they realized he's just a guy, but their problem is that the other two guys are even more just a guys, and they really need to commit to their best Jag and Myles Gaskin and just be done with the Salvin Ahmed, Malcolm Brown stuff for now, because just none of them are great. Gaskin is the best. He's like the most confident. He's basically kind of like a Jamal Williams. He's like a slightly worse version of Jamal Williams. He's a worse version of Jamal Williams.
Yeah,
is what I would tab Myles Gaskin as. And it's not good if that's your best running back, but that is the Dolphins' best running back. And I can't believe I'm saying this, but I think the Dolphins do need to make a greater commitment to Myles Gaskin, I feel like, going forward.
Sure. I mean, I think it'd be good for clarity purposes for fantasy managers.
This is good for their backfield too. I mean, how often do we see these things? That it's like, it just seems like, unless you're like a really good coach, it's not good for your offense to be like shuttling in different running backs on like every play. And like the offense kind of craves continuity itself. And like, I mean, rhythm we know is like totally overrated. Like, not, but it's not like a big thing, but it is kind of a thing. Like, the offense probably just wants to get in. How can you get in rhythm if like there's a different running back in every third snap?
That's a good question.
And the Dolphins probably just need to commit a little harder to Myles Gaskin. From zero RB to there are zero good receivers in our skill group. We're going to check in on some of the least valuable pass catching groups through 2 weeks. And just, should we be rostering anyone in here? We're going to start with the Saints. This is the one I really wanted to talk about. Most of these we're going to focus on just receiver cores. Saints, I just want to focus on like all the pass catchers. And like, if you have to roster a Saints pass catcher right now, Denny, who are you rostering?
Oh, God. I mean, I guess it's Callaway. I guess it's still Marquez Callaway. Are you talking about the tight ends too?
Yeah, I'm including Saints. I'm including all pass catchers. Because I feel like there's not a clear. Marcus Callaway probably is still like the stock answer, and you can still have some expectations for Marcus Callaway. But I just didn't know. I would entertain answers other than Marcus Callaway.
Right. Well, Saints. Yeah. Just looking at target share, you have, total opportunity share. Alvin Kamara with 40%, second is Marquez Callaway with 6%. So it seems to be a very concentrated offense, as we suspected coming into the season.
Yes.
Man, I know you wrote about Jameis Winston and the Saints offense and the difference between week one and two. I don't know if, you know, we need to split the difference. Maybe you can offer a little more input here. Split the difference between week one and two. But if it's anything like week two, that everybody in that offense, including Kamara, is in trouble. And I don't think that there is a single fantasy relevant wide receiver on the team for 12 team league purposes.
I think the difference will eventually be split. It's too good of a coach. It's a pretty good offensive line still. Too good of a running back. And Jameis Winston, for all of his foibles, like, is a playmaker. But the difference isn't going to be split in week three, I don't think, where they're making a road trip to New England. Worst possible bounce back spot. I mean, Bill Belichick confirmed he can still like eat bad quarterbacks lunches in week two. I mean, he just sent Zach Wilson straight to hell. Like, he was like Joe Strummer sending Zach Wilson straight to hell. It was a very, very bad Sunday for the young man. And it's hard to see things going any better for Jameis Winston. And so, too, though, I think I still like the Saints offensive line. They had the lowest pass block win rate in the league in week two. They got totally overwhelmed by the Panthers defensive line. Maybe you could argue the Panthers gambled, like, this is a turnover prone quarterback. There are no playmakers. So maybe they really got to tee off, pin their ears back, and like not have to worry, like gamble the Saints couldn't make plays, and they didn't make plays. Cause I think the offensive line will still be solid for the Saints. I also think I wrote about this in the article too. It's just, maybe I sometimes feel like I'm getting a too real football guy, but like, I think a huge problem for the Saints is just the complete lack of a targets hierarchy. Like, Jameis Winston doesn't have a go-to third down receiver. He doesn't have a go-to deep threat yet. You know, he doesn't have a go-to like safety valve beyond like Alvin Kamara. He just doesn't know. He doesn't have like a instinctual first read in like any given situation yet. Cause it's just such a sorry group of pass catchers, and I don't see how that gets better anytime soon. And I just see no way it gets better in week three against the Patriots.
I would say, and this might be, you know, too hot of a take for broadcast, but I would say they miss Michael Thomas.
They do. Yeah. It's fair to say, I would say, and they need to be turning up somewhat. I mean, this group isn't going to work. Marcus Callaway can maybe still be like a good number three receiver. Marcus Callaway is not dead, by the way. Like, this guy was from like the end of last season, all off season, was generating hype from like good beat writers down in New Orleans and from the coaching staff. I don't think he's been a victim of two completely horrible game scripts. Week one, they didn't need to pass. Week two, they were just in hopeless passing situations. I'm still rostering Marcus Callaway if I can. Maybe I'm just getting into sunk costs though, because I have Marcus Callaway in a lot of leagues and I'm dabbling in sunk cost fallacy already, but yeah. They need the targets too badly, and I still think he profiles as their best option. And that, like, the floor is going to have to – he's going to at least start getting 5 to 6 targets. And I'm holding on to Marcus Callaway if I can spare the roster spot, basically.
Fair enough.
The Raiders wide receivers, Denny.
Yeah.
We got three guys who are all, like, kind of rosterable. And, well, more than kind of. Henry Ruggs, Brian Edwards, and Hunter Renfrow. Through 3 weeks, who would you prioritize? And all three of these guys can be justifiably rostered, I feel like. I mean, they're not going to be anywhere close to universally rostered. Who would you prioritize amongst the Raiders wide receivers?
Right. Well, if you can get Darren Waller, you get him. I'm kidding.
That's big. That's huge.
You know,
Adam-wise, we need to clip that one real quick.
He's out there in a lot of 14 leagues, so watch out. Now, you know, Hunter Renfrow is a PPR thing, like, for real. This team can't run, doesn't try to run, doesn't care. They have embraced the all-out Derek Carr gonna throw it 40 times a game approach, which I didn't think would work. Through 2 weeks, it's working. And Hunter Renfrow and Darren Waller are just soaking up targets. Waller accounts for 32% of the targets, Renfrow 19%. Next in line is Henry Ruggs with 13%, tied with Kenyon Drake. Edwards down to 10% through 2 weeks. So, you know, Renfrow is playing a ton of snaps in the slot. Obviously, that's where he lives. And he is the secondary option behind Waller, no doubt about that. I do think, though, that Henry Ruggs is getting interesting. And I know you hate it. You hate it, and I somewhat hate it too, because I don't really have a lot of Ruggs anywhere.
You're taking us back to the 2020 podcast with Josh Norris, where Henry Ruggs was the only player we ever discussed.
But wait on it. Here's according to my notes. So like I said, second in wide receiver targets on the team. So his average depth of target is 15.5 yards, which is about 2 yards lower than his 2020 ADOT. It's not insignificant. It's lower than Brian Edwards' average depth of target, and his 178 air yards is second on the team behind Waller. Just to give you some context as to what 178 air yards means, that's more than Amari Cooper, Terry McLaurin, and Marquez Valdez-Scantling. So if I just to name a few, what I'm saying is Ruggs is not the guy last year where he was just told to go run fly routes down the sideline. Like, they're using him in somewhat varied ways enough, I think, to give fantasy managers some hope that if they continue this really pass heavy ways in Vegas, that Ruggs could, you know, produce somewhat viable weekly production with, of course, the blow up week, which is what he had last week, catching a 61 yard touchdown against the Steelers. His usage is different. We have to acknowledge that.
Yeah, I mean, I do agree. And you laid it out perfectly. And this was the first week kind of doing my preliminary rankings on Tuesday morning, where I was kind of like finally kind of like looking for ways to get Henry Ruggs up there. Cause you would think he's too good to be as bad as he was last year. He's also just too important. He's too critical for this offense. They had to change up what they were doing with him, cause they can't afford for him to be a zero. So if you got to start using him closer to line, even if it's not close to the line of scrimmage, you'd start using him closer to the line of scrimmage, like do it. To get the ball in his hands, because we know if there's one thing we know for sure, like if he can get the ball in his hands, he will be dangerous. Like,
yes.
we know that. That's like one thing that's like not debatable about Henry Ruggs. So do what you can to get the ball in his hands. And like you said, they are starting to make a more concerted effort to do that. And the indicator lights are looking a lot better on Henry Ruggs. And by the way, you said that Hunter Renfrow, I think you said built a home in the slot. I think he has like a thatch hut in the slot. He's built a home there.
And you know what? He's the first one in the morning, last one out at night.
Of course. I mean, here's the deal with Hunter Renfrow. He gets there at 12:01 a.m. and he leaves at 11:59 p.m. He sleeps for 1 minute inside a vending machine, but it's also like one of those like chambers that those teams have. I forget, what do you call those?
Chambers that like accelerate your sleep.
Yeah, he sleeps for 1 minute in one of those chambers exactly at midnight.
But it's the equivalent of 6 hours.
Yeah, and for the other 23 hours and 59 minutes of the day, he's studying the playbook. And
hyperbolic chamber?
I thought it was hyperbaric. Yeah, I don't. It's not hyperbolic. I think it's hyperbaric.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Talking about hard work. If you're not insane with sleep deprivation, are you working hard enough? No. That's the question you should be asking.
And everyone knows the less sleep you get, the higher quality your work is. everyone knows this. It's been proven by study after study. Don't look it up. Don't Google it. If you're getting more than 4 hours of sleep a night, you're just not going to be doing good work.
That's why Russell Wilson hasn't slept since 2011.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, you got to grind. You got to grind. And I will say, the tragedy of the Raiders, man, like, say what you will about John Gruden is a legitimately good designer of offense. And like game, I think that's been clear the entire 3 years he's been back, this being the fourth year. Like, he really does. He was worth the hype as someone who could design offense. Actually, like the things he can do with Derek Carr are highly impressive, you know, like kind of an ordinary quarterback talent. But just imagine if this team had not burned so many draft picks. It's just mind boggling. What better position the Raiders could be in, because John Gruden knows how to design an offense.
They should consider getting a good personnel guy in there.
He's just like the ultimate. He's being held. I think Kyle Shanahan, but I'm starting to really dabble in truthing Kyle Shanahan, man. Like, this guy is too emotional to be making personnel decisions. Like, he falls in love and trades up for you, and then you're dead to him somehow, like 8 months later. Like, he is too emotional to be making their personnel decisions for the San Francisco 49ers.
Agreed.
The season is here, so get an edge on your competition with player rankings, projections, tiers, and alerts for the players both on your team and those you are eyeing up on the waiver wire by signing up for NBC Sports Edge Plus, and do it at a discount. Use the promo code GOOD10 and get 10% off your annual subscription. That is GOOD10 for 10% off your NBC Sports Edge Plus subscription at NBCSportsEdge.com/win. We got one more receiver group to talk about here. I mean, it'd be tough to kind of call this a receiver group. By the letter of the law, it is a group of men who play wide receiver. But the Detroit Lions, Denny, any of these receivers worth rostering? It's, let's say, 12-team leagues. I mean, almost everyone's worth rostering in a 14-team league. Is there any Lions receiver that you really feel is worth a roster spot in 12-team leagues?
As long as Tyrell Williams is out, he was out in week two with a concussion. If he misses any more time, I think Quintez Cephas is rosterable. I don't really know what sort of team in a 12-team league would need to start him. I guess multiple flex spots, maybe.
There's a war on kickers. They're being removed. While you were sleeping, kicker democracy is dying in darkness. You didn't push back, and look what happened.
That's right.
Not you, Denny, but just the people in general. You didn't push back, and now look what happened to our kickers.
That's right. So, I would say Cephas, you know, St. Brown is not a thing. Not going to be a thing, I don't think, in that offense. No. Beyond that, I don't know. I think it's just Hockenson season every week. Just real quick as an aside, with the pace of that Lions offense and the number of plays they're running on a weekly basis and the game script that they're seeing, Hockenson is going to be the tight end three.
I was going to say, I've ranked him ahead of George Kittle this week. I don't know if that'll be my final ranking, but is he already the tight end three? Or are we getting ahead of ourselves?
No, I think he is. I mean, you obviously, there's probably not going to be – a time where you ever rank him higher than three. I mean, three is as high as you can go. It's like tight end one because yeah. Kelce and Waller are untouchable, you know, and they're like receivers basically. And so, Hockenson, just the volume has been great, will continue to be great. There's really nobody else there besides like Swift, who looked great actually against the Packers in limited usage. But to get back to your question, I think it's Cephas or Bus or Tyrell Williams when he comes back.
But Hockenson, by the way, I think like the final test for him is that he's never been a guy that was like game planned for or like taken away. I mean, I'm sure he was occasionally his first 2 years in the league, but now like it's been confirmed to the league, like, okay, we're gonna have to roll coverage to TJ Hockenson. We're gonna have to get like a Hockenson stopper, and we'll see how he responds to that test. That's like the final thing kind of standing between him and every week tight end three status, because George Kittle is probably still by the letter of the law, the tight end three. And George Kittle could still break Travis Kelce and Darren Waller's like ironclad grip on the top two if he like actually stays healthy. Because it's talking about a team that needs targets, the 49ers. But how Hawk kind of like deals with this final test of being a guy that's like game planned for, it's kind of like his final tight end three boss, I would say. I also think, by the way, Quintus Cephas, who I've got rostered in a few 14-team leagues, but notably not 12-team leagues. And that's really, someone's getting, even Amon-Ra could come on the second half of the season, because there are going to be weeks where Hawk does just get taken away.
Maybe, but I don't know, man. I feel like I'd rather play like Khalif Raymond over St. Brown at this point.
Yeah, I mean, you don't need to roster him. Let's put it that way. You do not need to roster Amon-Ra St. Brown in redraft leagues. They need to end the show. We're not ending the show right now. Our final topic for the show for today, wanted to check in on some defenses that have been displaying vulnerabilities against tight ends up the seam, and how they can maybe start being attacked for streaming purposes. This is like a question, because tight end is looking thin as usual. We're already in streaming season, and like tight end streaming is one of the most important parts of fantasy, unless you get one of those big three or four. So we'll begin with the Houston Texans, Danny, who you informed me are displaying major vulnerabilities against tight ends.
Yeah, and I didn't focus on teams that are giving up tons of catches and yardage to Waller and Kelce.
That makes sense. Yeah,
kind of goes without saying. So I avoided those.
The Ravens start every tight end against the Ravens.
That's right.
Their numbers are just horrific. Yes. I haven't looked up the tight ends they faced the first 2 weeks, but they're just horrific against tight ends.
and just don't look up who they played, and it'll
look it up.
It'll be better. Houston has given up 18 tight end catches. That's the second most in the league so far. Tight ends are seeing an unbelievable 30% target share against Houston. I know it's spread out, but Brown's tight ends saw a dozen targets in week two against the Texans. If we could combine all that into one person, it would be cool, I will say. Dan Arnold, who may or may not have been mentioned on the show 50 times this offseason, he gets the Texans this week on a short week. Dan Arnold showed signs of life last week, 55 receiving yards on, I believe, three receptions. it's a start, folks.
It's a start.
The Texans are vulnerable to tight ends. I'm offering this information as a way for you to look ahead and say, who do the Texans play next week? How about the next week? And try to line up your streamers ahead of time instead of scramble to get guys or blow a bunch of fab money on these guys. Do we want to move on to the next team here?
We do. We're going to move on to the New York Football Giants, Denny.
Yes. Giants have given up 17 tight end catches. Remember, the Texans have given up 18, so Giants are third in receptions to tight ends. 26.6% target share to tight ends. Kyle Pitts gets them this week. And Kyle Pitts, apparently, according to an Athletic article dissecting his usage through 2 weeks, has lined up in 14 different positions for the Falcons. I did not know there were 14 positions for a tight end to line up in.
Not either.
Apparently there are. One of them was standing on Matt Ryan's shoulders before the snap. Very strange, but we'll go with it.
He got sacked on that play, so I don't think we're going to go back to that one.
it's not a good setup. It's not a good usage, but it does qualify. Anyway, Giants are getting just crushed by tight ends. And, you know, the Giants were very vulnerable to tight ends for most of last year, too. So watch out for them. Finally, we have the Jaguars, the Jags have given up 13 tight end catches, which is the sixth most. And tight ends have averaged 9 targets per game against Jacksonville. That, you know, Max Williams comes into play this week. Now,
these have not faced good tight ends either.
That's right. Right. So we're talking about Houston and we're talking about who they lose to this week.
The team the Jaguars played.
Denver. But Denver.
Okay, no offense, good. I just legitimately already like who cares who the Jaguars played in week 2? It doesn't matter.
But the Broncos tight end 2, Albert O,
who's last name
I have not mastered yet. What's his last name?
I've seen as much Albert O football as anyone in the nation, and I never once could pronounce his last name, which is bad. I should know how to pronounce, but in Mizzou, he was just known solely as Albert O. That's what we call him.
So Albert O had 4 catches on 4 targets against the Jags team. And the Jags, like the Giants, gave up a ton of production, a ton of weekly targets to tight ends last year. So nothing has changed. I know you're shocked about that. So if you can stream guys against the Jags in the coming weeks throughout the season, you do it. This week it's Max Williams. I don't know what to say about Max Williams. His usage wasn't off the charts. He had a big week, 94 yards on 7 catches, I believe, against the Vikings. But he, you know, he's not like a must start or anything. Just note that teams are ripping the Jags, the Texans, and the Giants with tight ends.
And like it helps too that. I mean, maybe even if they have decent tight end decent tight end personnel, but they're going to be like just so easy to throw against both the it's just going to be open season again, basically every position for the Jaguars and Texans.
Right. That's true,
including very much up the seam. So really good stuff because like this is I'm already like doing the rankings like. Wishing I had more data, like, okay, who's actually getting like ripped up? Who's getting burned up the seam? Mm-hmm. All right. So there's really good stuff to know.
Yeah.
Because like get ahead of the curve, on who we should be streaming against. So excellent stuff, Denny. The lawyers, in fact, we're not even gonna have any depositions this week. They're very pleased with what you've been showing this week. So
thank God.
Taking a week off. Yeah, you can stop paying their legal fees even for this week.
I'll be able to afford lunch now.
Yeah, we'll say they're $2,000 lunches per person. And this is a big legal team. Thankfully you're off the hook this week.
How many martinis? Come on, guys.
Jeez. So, do you really have to have all your meetings at the Ritz-Carlton in New York, you guys? I have not. There's way more expensive stuff than the Ritz-Carlton in New York, but still. That does it for today. A short show, Denny. Wow. A lot of really good topics. Hopefully you found some actionable information. Check out some actionable information on the site from Jack Miller's Strength and Numbers article going up on Tuesday. Got Denny's Target Decoder coming out, my rankings coming out on Thursday, everything you know and love of the site, our first preview show for week 3 tomorrow, followed up by the second on Thursday. Check that out. Rate, review, subscribe to this podcast, A Good Football Show. For Denny Carter, I am Patrick Daugherty. We will catch you tomorrow.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to keepitfunohio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Start clean with Clorox, because Clorox delivers a powerful clean every time. Because messes happen. Because...
Hey, listen. Remember how you told me to toss those takeout containers before we left for vacation? And you were like, I'm serious. If that leaks over the counter, it'll be a slimy abomination by the time I get back. And I was like, yeah, of course. Don't worry about it. I won't forget. Well.
Ooh, yeah, that happens. So start clean with Clorox. Use Clorox products as directed. Rinse after use if in contact with food surface.